This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, January 8th, 2020. Ahead, Raven Cook examines the life of Arkansan John Walker Sr., legislator, educator, attorney, and community leader, in a new edition of Reflections in Black. And a new year, a new music calendar. Timothy Dennis gives us a preview of the weekend ahead. After our show at 1, it's Here and Now. Economics reporter Adam Davidson says we're living in the wrong economy. And the one that is most relevant today is the passion economy. A conversation with Davidson and the latest on Iran on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR right after Ozarks at Large. Siloam Springs residents have an opportunity this evening to meet the city's new police chief, Alan Gilbert. He'll be at a meet and greet at the Siloam Springs Library from 5 to 7 tonight. The event is sponsored by the City of Siloam Springs, the Siloam Springs Police Department, and the Siloam Springs Public Library. This is Ozarks at Large. I am with Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek, who I imagine got some rest after last night's city council meeting in Fayetteville.
I did get a little bit of rest. Yeah, it went pretty late, as these meetings tend to go lately.
All right. There was more than one topic on the agenda, but one that had a lot of people's attention was about a new parking deck in Fayetteville. Remind us why this conversation is taking place.
So the parking deck is part of the bond package that voters passed back in April last year. And it's tied to the Cultural Arts Corridor project, which includes turning the Walton Arts Center parking lot into a civic plaza, a park, a gathering space. So the city allocated $10 million for a new parking deck after business owners, residents, and visitors expressed some concern about losing the parking spaces right across from the Walton Arts Center. So in order to appease those people and come to an agreement, the city decided that it would build a parking deck first before it could start any construction on a civic plaza. So it would replace those parking spaces with a parking deck. The city proposed three options for the parking deck. One is the lot at West and Dixon, where a lot of people know that our Sega's at the depot. That's where they're located. The parking lot on School Avenue across from the Spring Street deck behind Kingfish. That's another option.
Kingfish, a bar in Fayetteville.
Yes. And the third option is the site of Nadine Baum Studios, which is across from Theater Squared, which brings us to the discussion that started last month just before the holidays.
All right. So, and again, the way this is working is the new parking facility has to be built before work starts on the park that will replace the current parking lot.
That's correct.
All right, so the city council considered a couple of items last night that had to do with this parking deck. What was the first one that was discussed?
So that first item had to do with an amended resolution proposed by Alderman Kyle Smith. The resolution removed the Nadine Baum site as an option for the parking deck, which, if people aren't familiar with the area, that's where Theater Squared used to produce its productions before moving into their new building across the street. The Nadine Baum site is owned by the city and the University of Arkansas, so it makes negotiations for a parking deck a little bit more complicated. Numerous arts programs are run out of that building. So if the city wanted to build a parking deck there, it would have to replace Nadine Baum Studios, which would put that project way over the $10 million budget allocated for the parking deck. The resolution also encourages the mayor to seek opportunities for partnerships that would add other features to the parking deck, like workforce housing and arts production facilities. That part of the resolution isn't binding. The mayor and the city council don't have to include these amenities, but Kyle Smith did say that those goals were important to include in the resolution, which passed 7-1 last night.
You mentioned workforce housing. How would that
factor into the parking deck?
So this was an idea that was brought up by the Fayetteville Housing Authority, including affordable housing. So the keywords there are workforce and affordable, meaning that people who perhaps are involved in the arts or in the service industry could afford to live downtown. And the Fayetteville Housing Authority, of course, operates several public housing complexes and runs a voucher program for low-income residents. And this idea does have support from some members of the city council, but there was a little bit of pushback last night. Mainly city attorney Kit Williams says he's concerned about tying affordable housing to the bond issue, since there was no mention of that on the ballot when the bond package went to a vote. He says tying taxpayer dollars to housing could open the city to litigation. Williams says he's also concerned about what this could mean for the timeline of the project, because that bond money does have to be spent within a certain time period. Take a listen to what he had to say.
It takes a lot of time to build a deck, and then it takes a lot of time to build the Cultural Arts Plaza. And so any delays can be very difficult for us, because obviously you have to spend bond funds within 3 years of receipt, most of them. So I'm very concerned about trying to change what the purpose of this bond issue was, which is to build a parking deck.
So that was City Attorney Kit Williams that you heard there. Housing Authority Executive Director Angela Belford also spoke at the meeting. She urged the city to consider housing in their design. She says it could be done through partnerships and other sources of funding that wouldn't include taxpayer dollars. She also says past city projects were focused on solving one problem at a time, and she wants this project to be different.
Yes, the decision is for a $10 million parking deck, and that decision can be made in such a way that limits the possibilities of the rest of the space on that lot. Or it can be made in such a way that is going to leave those possibilities as an option.
Angela Belford, Housing Authority Executive Director in Fayetteville, speaking at last night's Fayetteville City Council meeting. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitecker is there. She's with us right now explaining where we are on this parking deck process in Fayetteville. One more item on last night's agenda. Tell me about that.
Yes, there was.
Well, I should say more than one more item, but one more that had to deal with the parking deck.
Yes, that's correct. So there was another resolution that has to do with one of the other locations proposed for the parking deck, and that's the corner of West and Dixon. Right now, that land is privately owned. So the resolution would authorize the mayor to sign letters of intent with Sage Partners, which represents the Bank of Fayetteville and Fayetteville Depot, which both own portions of that lot. The resolution would authorize the city to buy 0.6 acres of that lot for $350,000. The conceptual design includes a 400-space parking deck with a liner building, as well as a hotel and a bank. The two buildings on that lot, one of which is home to Arcega's, would be left untouched, but they would have to share the space with a parking deck and a hotel. Some have opposed this idea, including Carrie Arcega, the owner of Arcega's, who says it would be bad for his business. Others have raised concerns about buying land using taxpayer money that would go to a private developer. The city council did not vote on this resolution, but they did vote 8-0 to table it for another 2 weeks to allow more time for discussion.
There is a third option, right? And it is on School Avenue. What about that?
A few people brought this up last night, mostly supporting it because it's already owned by the city. Mm-hmm. So there wouldn't have to be—
The transaction would be easier, presumably.
Right, right. The only downside that people did bring up is that there would be two parking structures that would basically dominate a whole city block. The bottom line from last night is that this discussion is far from over, so you can expect a lot more conversations about this.
I bet. So far from over, but there is that eventual deadline, so something has to be decided at some point.
That's correct. Right now, and there is a timeline for this project because of the amount of time the city has to spend the bond money. So right now, the timeline is that a parking deck would be finished by late 2021, mm-hmm. and the Civic Plaza would be done by late 2022. So that's another concern that was brought up last night, is that a decision does have to be made soon so that the project remains on track.
Susanna Sitek, covering the Fayetteville City Council for us. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
This is Ozarks at Large. Last month, Washington Regional Women and Infant Center received a cuddle cot as a gift from the Chandler and Paisley Skies Foundation. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the cooling bassinet allows bereaved families to spend more time with deceased stillborn and newborn infants.
Inside Washington Regional Medical Center, Heather Bailey, director of the Women and Infants Center, opens a case which contains a mobile cuddle cot recently donated to the hospital. She switches it on. The device, designed to cool the body of an infant who's died before birth or soon after, is compact and whisper quiet.
It does have a fan that cools, but it's a very quiet fan. You wouldn't even notice it over the air conditioning.
A tube extends from the tabletop cooling unit to a blue inflatable mat, which is tucked inside a special bassinet on which deceased infants are placed. The cuddle cot operates at 8 degrees Celsius, 46 degrees Fahrenheit.
The cuddle cot has a mechanism which we put water in, and it is cooled and passed to a pad that the infant lays on.
Bailey says traditionally, deceased stillborn and newborn infants are taken to hospital morgues for cooling to slow decomposition, then returned to maternity wards to parents and families seeking additional bereavement time.
What this cuddle cot actually does for us is allow the infants to stay in the room with the parents while they're here the entire time if they would like.
Bailey says after carrying a child for months in the womb, mothers find it extremely difficult to physically separate from their deceased infants. A 2016 study published in the Journal of Women's Health reveals a higher incidence of depression and post-traumatic stress for such moms. But a survey published in 2017 in the European Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Reproductive Biology reveals that parents allowed to hold and spend more time with infants who've died with the help of cold cots yielded positive psychological outcomes. Some hospitals are even allowing families to take cuddle cots home where they can attain even more closure.
For us here, it's going to extend it to their entire stay. So obviously that has limits. If we have someone who's here for weeks on end, that would not extend there. Our typical stay for a patient like this would be about 48 hours, and so they can keep the infant with them that time.
Washington Regional delivers more than 2,500 infants a year. The hospital doesn't disclose mortality data, but Bailey says a pair of trained staff bereavement specialists work with maternity medical staff on how to best manage infant death.
The death of an infant is never expected, and so even when parents know prior to delivery that their infant has died in utero, they have time to prepare, but the grief really doesn't hit them until the delivery, for the most part. They want to hold their baby. They want to love their baby because they're not going to be taking their baby home with them as they had anticipated.
The cuddle cot donated to Washington Regional in mid-December is not designed for pediatric death, Bailey says.
No, any gestational age. So infants who were very small up to full-term infants.
Jacqueline Keeter, Director of Development and Outreach Services for Washington Regional, says the cuddle cot was donated by the Chandler and Paisley Skies Foundation, headquartered in Northwest Arkansas.
Right. So Chandler and Paisley Skies Foundation was created by Michelle and Dusty Hurst. They were expecting a set of twins, and in 2014, they lost those twins at 22 weeks. Michelle gave birth, and so they both lived about a day. And so they created this foundation in their memory specifically to provide cuddle cots for hospitals so that they can better care for families who are experiencing the same things.
Cuddle cots, developed by the British company Flexmort in 2011, are carefully engineered, expensive devices, Keeter says.
A cuddle cot costs just under about $3,000.
The Chandler and Paisley Skies Foundation co-founder Michelle Hurst says she and her husband Dusty set up their foundation in 2017, 3 years after losing their twin newborns.
When we lost Chandler and Paisley, we did not have one of these cooling devices. We had not actually heard of it either. And after becoming part of the loss community, so to speak, we were educated about these type of devices.
Hurst says the foundation is in its infancy, but they expect it to flourish.
So we've only actually placed two cots so far. We placed one in December of 17, and that was at Willow Creek, which was the hospital where we delivered Chandler and Paisley. And then Washington Regional received the second unit just last month.
Which, being newly donated, has not yet been utilized, but the Hursts have been told that the cuddle cot donated to Willow Creek is.
We have heard of a couple of things that bring us comfort. It's very bittersweet, but I do know a couple was experiencing a pregnancy where they knew that the baby would pass away shortly after birth, and they knew they would be able to have the comfort of having additional time because of that device. And I did actually just learn of another family who used it, and some comments that were made were that that device really gave them time to build memories. And some family were able to travel in, see the baby, and have that time for pictures and to get memories prior to needing to leave the hospital.
The Chandler and Paisley Skies Foundation is not yet supported by major donors, but small donations are being made by family and friends.
What really allowed us to do the donation for Washington Regional was we set up a fundraiser on Facebook for Chandler and Paisley's fifth birthday, which was in October. And the results of that fundraiser actually allowed us to raise enough to purchase the cuddle cot for Washington Regional. And since then, we've received another donation from good friends of ours. So we're well on our way to purchasing a third in 2020.
The cuddle cots are a practical and precious way to provide comfort to parents suffering the loss of stillborn and newborn infants. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And ahead on our show, remember that scene in The Graduate when Benjamin is encouraged to invest his future in one word, plastics? Well, more than 50 years later, that conversation might take place with another one word, information. Data is an important and growing currency in business and technology, and the University of Arkansas's Sam M. Walton College of Business will soon offer a Master's of Science in Economic Analytics.
And so a couple of companies have actually told us that, economists make the best problem solvers they have because, economics is really about understanding how the world works and trying to understand the motivations and the underlying forces that drive behavior.
Economics, analytics, the future, and more ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large. The National Weather Service forecasts increasing cloudiness tonight with lows across the region in the mid-40s. Tomorrow, clouds remain with a 50% chance of showers or drizzle. Highs tomorrow afternoon around 60. Thursday night, showers likely with thunderstorms possibly developing late. Lows in the mid-50s. And the Friday outlook, a 90% chance of rain, some possibly severe thunderstorms Friday. Highs Friday afternoon from the mid to upper 60s throughout the area.
This is Reflections in Black, and I'm your host, Raven Cook. Reflections in Black is a segment dedicated to exploring the legacy of Black Americans in the United States and around the globe. Reflections in Black also provides resources for understanding and hope for all people. Born on June 3, 1937 in Hope, Arkansas, Representative John Walker Sr. attended Yerger High School in Hope and graduated from Jack Yates High School in 1954 in Houston, Texas. With a commitment to education, Walker went on to receive a Bachelor's of Sociology in 1958 from the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff, a Master's in 1961 from the New York University, and a Juris Doctorate degree in 1964 from Yale Law School. Admitted to the Arkansas State Bar in 1964, Walker went on to work for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in New York City. By 1965, John Walker opened up his own solo practice in Little Rock, Arkansas, with a focus on civil rights. As the turbulent 1960s concluded, many of Walker's early cases involved racial discrimination in corporate America. And in 1968, Walker went on to open the first of three racially integrated law firms in the South. The firm was acknowledged as a leader in the work to file the first lawsuit in the nation for harmful effects of racially segregated schools in Arkansas and for the damages suffered by Arkansas African American children by the loss of benefits from federally funded school programs. Walker was inducted into the Arkansas Black Hall of Fame in 1999 and was awarded the designation of Southern Trial Lawyer of the Year with its War Horse Award in 2004. He ran for the Arkansas House of Representatives 34th District position in 2010, placing first in the primary and runoff and winning the general election. A Democratic member of the Arkansas House of Representatives since January 2011, Walker served four terms representing District 34. Walker also served as a principal at John W. Walker Law Firm in Little Rock and practiced law throughout Arkansas and the surrounding states. The recipient of numerous awards for his legal work from the NAACP and also throughout the state of Arkansas, Walker passed away on October 28, 2019. His passing continues to be felt throughout the state of Arkansas, a state he served passionately until his passing. Today, we honor and celebrate the life of one of Arkansas's most committed leaders, the late Representative John Walker Sr.
Reflections in Black is a production of KUAF Public Radio, 91.3 FM in Fayetteville. You can hear weekly segments on Ozarks at Large, and you can hear past editions of the program at KUAF.com. Just search Reflections in Black.
Happy Wednesday. This is Ozarks at Large. We are living in an information explosion. How we shop, how we play, and how we travel all generate information. But just because businesses, nonprofits, and agencies have access to more information than ever before, doesn't mean those organizations know exactly what to do with that information. The Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas is launching a new Master's in Science in Economics Analytics to prepare more people to work in the field. Raja Kali, Professor and Department Chair Economics and ConocoPhillips Chair in International Economics and Business at the Walton College, recently came to our studio to talk about the new master's degree that will launch in the fall. He says economic analytics is a fusion of economic theory and economic modeling that take advantage of significant advances allowing economists to deliver manageable information from big data. He says understanding data is a core skill of the future.
And that's because what's happened in the last 10 years is that we have seen an explosion of data. So we've gone from a situation where firms and the government, federal government, state government, did not have the right data or good data to answer the interesting questions, relevant questions that they had, such as, you know, how do consumers behave? What kind of products do they like? You know, if government regulations are changed, how will it change individual behavior? And so on. So we've gone from a situation where, you know, firms and the government did not have data to a situation where there is a data deluge. And that's because, as you know, everything we do now generates data.
Everything. Every website we visit, every step we take.
Apps that we use.
Yeah.
Even our cars, in many cases our houses. And we're on the cusp of this revolution that is called the Internet of Things, where virtually everything will come equipped with sensors that will not only, you know, capture the data but also transmit it to the Internet, to some firm or repository where, in principle, it could be analyzed.
You mentioned that this explosion of data. I imagine if you're a government or firm, just to have the data can be overwhelming. Yes, knowing what to do with it and to do properly.
Yes, so that's exactly where I think, you know, a program like ours or this general area fits in. So basically, we've gone from a situation where we've had data scarcity to a situation where we have a data deluge or a torrent of data. And so now the scarcity is of people who are trained and skilled enough to harness the data, to analyze the data, to see patterns in the data, to visualize the data, and then use this data, these patterns, and this analysis to tell stories, drive decision-making, and really use data as a resource. And so we've gone from that kind of situation to this kind of situation where really the acute scarcity that firms and the government, governments of various levels are facing is a shortage of people who can do these kinds of things, you know, who can gain insights from the data and drive decision-making and so on. And so that's where, that's what we're trying to do by means of this program, where we've talked to various companies, you know, ranging from companies like Amazon and data analytics companies like IRI, which is like Nielsen, and healthcare companies like Duke University Hospital Systems, as well as Blue Cross Blue Shield, Arkansas Blue Cross Blue Shield, and several others, Visa Corporation. Mm. And basically, we've tried to design a program that, you know, fits the need for these companies as well as the federal government. We see graduates of our program going into virtually every sector of the economy, from retail to finance to healthcare. I think all of these sectors are areas where these skills could be applied. And so what we've heard from companies that we talked to before we designed the program is that they've been able to find people who are good at programming and can do the kind of things that they tell them to do. But what they really are finding a shortage of is people who can combine, you know, economic or business intuition with the programming or the data science skills. And so a couple of companies have actually told us that, you know, economists make the best problem solvers they have because, you know, economics is about, really about understanding how the world works mm-hmm. and trying to understand the motivations and the underlying forces that drive behavior. And so what they really want are people who are skilled in both areas, so to speak, you know, economic modeling and economic intuition, business intuition in general, and some of these latest cutting-edge analytical techniques, such as big data econometrics, machine learning, some of the latest computational programs, such as Python and R, and so on. And so what we're trying to do in this new program we've designed is, it's a one-year program, it's a two-semester, 10 months yeah. exactly, and is to teach people both economic modeling and economic intuition and teach them some of the latest of these computational and analytical techniques that I just described.
What should someone have in their experience, in their background, educationally or professionally, to enroll in this?
Right. This is a very good question. You know, we're not necessarily looking for people who are just economics majors or people who have an economics background. But we feel that what we want is a certain kind of mindset and openness to wanting to learn analytical techniques and wanting to use these to understand real-world problems in industry or government or in sort of society. And so we're really thinking that people who have a decent technical background, could be from physics, could be from engineering, could be from computer science. You know, generally speaking, you know, we're open to applicants of all backgrounds. It's just that they should have some comfort with and willingness to invest in, you know, analytical methods. And, you know, it's a bit of a challenging program, no doubt, because you have to learn some of these skills.
Modeling, there's science here. Right. Obviously, there's science right. here. But you've used the word intuition a couple of times,
yes.
which makes me think there's a bit of art
yes.
involved in this as well.
Certainly. So, you know, I like to talk about economics as the force, as in Star Wars. Mm-hmm. You know, it surrounds us, it penetrates us, and it binds the galaxy together. And so economics is really the force of the world of business. You know, and if you understand the ways of the force, that is economics, you know, you will be able to do all kinds of interesting and unexpected things. You'll be able to see things other people cannot see, understand patterns in the data or patterns in behavior. And that's where the intuition comes in. And so economics really gives a very sound foundation for intuition and an understanding of how individuals behave, you know, what drives their behavior, the various things that could nudge them to behave in a certain way or another. Why do firms behave in a certain way? Firms behave in a certain way. What is the impact of government policy? So economics gives you intuition about individual and firm behavior, essentially.
Is there, and this may not be a fair question, is there a limit to how predictive it can be? I think... You know, if we're thinking about things like climate change or rapid development of technology that may change consumers' behaviors?
Yes, certainly. So, of course, forecasting, even economic forecasting, is both an art and a science. And, you know, it's a bit like weather forecasting in that respect. But what's happening is that since the data is getting so much better and so much more detailed, you know, things can be predicted within certain levels of statistical confidence and things like that. I think the sort of judgment call is usually in the sense of what your vision of the future is. I mean, what economics and in combination with analytics can do is tell you, you know, if you were to, you know, launch this product or you were to change your behavior in a certain way, what are the likely outcomes and how would that impact you and others and so on. But, of course, there are so many other factors at work and there are so many unexpected things that are changing on an everyday basis. And so that's where I think the unexpected nature or the unintended consequences of policies or decisions can come in. And that's where I think the judgment call comes into play.
Amazon, Visa, Nielsen, these are big companies. Big, massive amounts of data can help smaller firms down to, I would assume, like a boutique on a town square?
Certainly.
The more you can know?
Certainly. And to some extent, I think that's a really good point because, you know, if you go back to the early days of the computer revolution, the PC revolution, you know, the big firms were the first firms to actually adopt those things. But really, the boost in productivity and, you know, the way it's changed the economy really began to happen when every firm started using computers in a big way, you know, down to the level of even, say, restaurants and, you know, things that we encounter on an everyday basis now use computers to manage their systems and so on. So I think the data analytics revolution is a bit like that also.
There are going to be some people listening to our conversation who are a little uneasy about big data, right? Big data is often said like big data. Should we be at all uneasy about an explosion of data?
Well, I think it's a fact of life now.
Yeah.
I mean, the world has changed just as, you know, various technological advances have changed the world that we live in. And we really can't go back. And so I think there are various uses of big data. And certainly there's need for some thinking about unintended consequences as well as, you know, things such as market power or monopoly power that can come from the control of, you know, or the ownership of huge amounts of big data. We see some of this in the recent sort of, you know, antitrust sort of discussions surrounding firms like Google or Amazon and Microsoft and so on, where, you know, these firms have so much data and so much control over how we behave and the products that we see. But every firm is like this. You can think about other examples like Netflix and so on.
Public radio stations measure their audience
exactly.
And how often they listen. Yeah.
So, you know, certainly, you know, it's a brave new world and we really don't know the full consequences of this. So I think there is some justification in being cautious or wary about it. But I feel like it's, you know, one of these technological revolutions which is, you know, transforming our lives and will transform our lives. And, you know, just as we were worried about the impacts of previous technological advances, you know, at some point people were worried about getting into elevators.
Right. So at the end of 10 months, at the end of the spring, and say you have taken the CBE and you have these three qualifications, it sounds like this is quite a personally marketable situation to be in. If you have this Master's of Science in Economic Analytics, you pass the CBE, and there's a shortage of people with your knowledge.
Yes. So that's a good point. So what we've heard from companies is that this need is only going to grow because, as I said, I think, you know, at some point, you know, data analytics will permeate our lives at a very micro level, and almost every firm will be using data analytics in some way. And we will also be subject to this in the sense that we interact with these firms as consumers and as individuals. So what we've heard from these firms is that they don't foresee, this is not a fad. So for example, Amazon plans to hire 100 to 150 such people every year for the foreseeable future.
Oh my.
So as far as they can see, they will continue and probably even grow their hiring of such people. So it is for almost every other company. So this is a market, in a sense, a sort of a niche that is expected to grow. You know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics expects the need for people with these kinds of skills to grow by about 8% a year, which is greater than the 5% a year for other professions. Starting salaries in this area are very good. Generally speaking, students can expect a starting salary of $75,000 to $85,000, which is going to grow rapidly. I mean, the average salary for master's level economists at the moment, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is about $104,000, but that's just the average. I mean, the median level,
right?
And that's growing very rapidly. This is already outdated. It's from 2018, so starting salaries are growing rapidly. So jobs in the area are not in short supply.
Raja Kali, Professor and Department Chair Economics and ConocoPhillips Chair in International Economics and Business at the Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas, visited with us recently to discuss the new Master's of Science of Economic Analytics that will be available in the fall at the U of A. He says three courses involved in the degree overlap with the already existing Master's of Information Systems program at the Walton College, so students will earn a certificate in Enterprises Systems. And at the end of the 10-month program, students will also be eligible to take the Certified Business Economist exam on campus. More information can be found at msecon.uark.edu. This is Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Support comes from Butterfield Trail Village, Northwest Arkansas retirement community catering to active lifestyles and resident well-being, offering apartments to village homes, plus a daily calendar of activities and events. ButterfieldTrailVillage.org for more.
And Happy New Year. Happy New Year to you, Timothy Dennis.
Happy New Year, Kyle.
For the first time in 2020, we're going to sit down and talk about live music coming our way.
So let's start with tomorrow night, Thursday night in Fayetteville. Dylan Earl is going to be on stage at George's Majestic Lounge in Fayetteville.
Mm-hmm. She was made up of yesterdays. I'm making my.
He'll be joined on that bill by Noah Richmond. That is actually a free show tomorrow night at George's. It should get underway at about 9 o'clock. Also happening tomorrow night in Fayetteville, on Dixon Street even, John Dooley's going to be at the Dixon Street Pub. Local singer-songwriter, kind of has a folk feel. That show should get underway at about 9:30 tomorrow night.
I'm assuming all of the shows at Dixon Street Pub this time of year are indoors.
I would assume so.
Yes.
Although it has been nice outdoor weather.
That's true.
Moving on, all still on Dixon Street tomorrow night, actually. Dominic B. Roy is going to be at Mickey Finn's. He is a local kind of bluesy, folksy singer-songwriter. That show gets underway at 8 o'clock. Again, that's Mickey Finn's in Fayetteville. And then finally, tomorrow night, but up in Rogers at Natural State Beer Company, Pat Ryan Key and Al Halpin will be on stage.
A Natural State Beer?
Yeah.
All right.
Say no.
That should start at about 6 o'clock tomorrow night. Again, Natural State Beer in Rogers. Moving on to Friday night, Mojo's Pints and Pies in Fayetteville is going to have State House Electric on stage.
Once I had a nickel, once I had a dime, rubbed them both together just like they were mine. Tax man took his cut and the landlord sent his bill. Lord, I do my part choking down that bitter pill. It's come and gone.
Will they be electric or acoustic?
I'm assuming they're going to be at least a little bit electric because they say it's going to be a full band show, even including a drummer. What? So there you go.
So electric drums? Is that what you're telling me?
I don't know if they'll go that far.
Okay.
This isn't 1980s synth stuff.
Right.
But anyway, that show gets underway at about 7 o'clock Friday night. Again, that's at Mojo's Pints and Pies in Fayetteville. Also in Fayetteville Friday night, Jesse Cook will be at Walton Arts Center.
We talked to him yesterday, or you did.
Yes, yes. And just briefly, I'll say that he is kind of a world music guitarist, plays a little bit of everything. Tickets start at $25 for that show. Some tickets are left, but I wouldn't dally because it seems like they're going pretty quickly. That show gets underway 8 o'clock Friday night, again, Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. Up in Bentonville Friday night, a band by the name of Framing the Red will be at Meteor Guitar Gallery.
I'm afraid I'll have to claim ignorance on Framing the Red.
They are a Mississippi-based kind of southern rock band.
Got a shotgun and a box of birds. Up about the chugging ass, what's a good word? Got shrooms in the pasture, growing up some laughter. If the cops show up, then it really don't matter. Around the fire, just writing the song. Got my family and friends, right where we belong. Got some peer pressure.
Tickets for that show are $10 advance, $15 day of. Gets underway at 8 o'clock Friday night. Again, that's at the Meteor in downtown Bentonville. Over in Eureka Springs, Chelsea's is going to have Makin' Loaf on stage. That show gets underway at 9:30 Friday night. Again, that's at Chelsea's in Eureka Springs. And then down in Fort Smith, Friends of the Family will be on stage at Harry's Downtown. Kind of a Grateful Dead cover band,
yeah.
Lots of jam tunes.
Yeah.
Tickets for that show are $7. It should get underway at 9 o'clock Friday night, again at Harry's Downtown in Fort Smith. Moving on to Saturday night, Funk Factory will be back on stage at George's Majestic Lounge.
Funk Factory is fun. They fill the stage.
Oh, yeah, and they're excellent musicians.
Yeah.
I look and stare so deep in your eyes. I'm touching you more and more every time. When you leave, I'm begging you not to go. Call your name 2-3 times in a row. Such a funny thing for me to try to explain. You inside of my pride is the one to blame. But I still don't understand just how you love can do it no one else can. Got me looking so crazy right now.
If you may recall, you know, last month, some of the musicians who are part of Funk Factory came in to promote the Smooth Man Christmas show.
And they were amazing.
They were incredible. I would expect nothing less from Funk Factory.
So that's Saturday night.
That's Saturday night at George's. Tickets are $10. Gets underway at about 9:30. Again, that's Saturday night. Also Saturday night, up in Bentonville, the Nines is going to have Simeon Basil on stage. He's a local singer-songwriter.
Little sleep money's gone, no more fun. I'll keep trudging by through the day. This feeling is just like fantasy. To fight for the gold. I know it's just a weekend job. It's all my luck. I can buy you pretty things, cause you're the one I adore.
That show gets underway at 8 o'clock Saturday night, again at the Nines in Bentonville. Also happening Saturday night, Candy Lee is going to be on stage at Growler USA in Rogers.
Exciting.
There's plenty of life happening here within the mountains, but the people here know how to stop and take it slow. Appreciating all their beautiful surroundings, making memories that we'll cherish down the road. And I will be your Ozark mama, and you can be.
That gets underway 8 o'clock, again at Growler USA, Saturday night. And then over in Eureka Springs, Saturday night, Route 358 will be on stage at Brews.
I know you think there's something here. It's kind of sparked like the stars burning in the atmosphere. But you should think twice, cause I'm not sure. You realize the train wreck that you're in.
One of the hardest working bands in show business.
Yeah, it seems like they're playing almost every weekend. That show gets underway at 7 o'clock. Again, that's Saturday at Brews in Eureka Springs. And then down in Fort Smith, Crescent City Combo is going to be on stage at Harry's Downtown.
Speaking of filling the stage.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, plenty of horns, plenty of everything.
Fill the room with sound.
Yes. Cover for that show is $7. Gets underway at 9 o'clock Saturday night. Again, that's at Harry's in downtown Fort Smith.
And then stay tuned, because Osmo Moo, which is the Ozark Mountain Music Festival in Eureka Springs.
Correct.
A completely indoor music festival. That's later this month, right?
I believe that's next weekend, if not the weekend after.
And Damn Neighbors, who are on one of the bills at Osmo Moo, will be on our show Friday.
That's correct.
With Antoinette Grajeda. All right, Timothy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In December, the Buffalo National River Park Service announced the first artist in its new Artists in Residence program. Samuel Benz, a poet in the University of Arkansas Masters of Fine Arts program, will lead creative activities in the park and produce artwork for the National Park Service during his three-week residency in Jasper. After this initial pilot program at the end of January, Park Ranger Lauren Ray says the Park Service will look at expanding the project. She recently spoke with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth.
So, Lauren, what is the Artist in Residence program, and why is this a project that the Buffalo National River wants to pilot?
The Artist in Residence program is something that the National Park Service has done for quite some time. There are at least 50 different residencies across the nation at National Park Service units. So what we're really aiming to do is help our park visitors connect in a more meaningful way with their park through the arts.
So what are some of the deliverables? What do you expect to get from your artist?
First of all, it's important to know that the Artist in Residence program is part of our larger volunteer program at the Buffalo. And so in exchange for park housing for about 2 to 3 weeks, we will expect the Artist in Residence volunteer to volunteer about 30 hours per week in doing art out in the field, in putting on public art programs. And then at the end of their residency, we will expect for them to donate 2 to 3 pieces of art to Buffalo National River for us to use in publications, on social media, and other forms of public outreach.
How do you hope people engage with the park through this program?
Well, when you're doing art in a beautiful outdoor setting, you're inherently going to be paying closer attention to details in the landscape, like shapes and colors, sounds and movements. And so artwork can help us connect in more meaningful ways with the places we love. And the idea of this program is for visitors to grow their appreciation and their stewardship for Buffalo National River by participating in art programs that will be facilitated by the Artist in Residence volunteer. Toward the end of Samuel's residency, we will be looking at putting on some sort of public presentation of the artwork that he created during his 3 weeks here. So that will probably take place at a local community library, or we may even host it in park.
So have you had an artist in residence before? Is this something that you're trying again, or is it the first time it's ever happened at the Buffalo National River?
We have had artists in residence in the past. It's been several years. And so we're trying to sort of reignite this program and see if we can make it sustainable.
What problems with sustainability did you have in the past, or how do you plan to make this more sustainable?
Really just making sure that we are offering these residencies during the right times of year. I think one of the issues in the past was that we just didn't have housing available at the times when we were trying to offer the residencies. So what we will be doing with this pilot program is exploring the winter season specifically, because that is when we tend to have a lot of vacancy in our park housing and we can accommodate these artists coming into the park.
And the current artist in residence, Samuel Benz, is a poet. So how did you choose him for the program?
So the artists in residence that we had in the past were mostly painters and photographers. So we have a lot of artwork in those types of media, but we don't have anything here at the Buffalo in the way of poetry or creative writing. And so Samuel has a very impressive resume. He's currently a graduate student at the University of Arkansas, pursuing a Master's of Fine Arts in Creative Writing. And he won an Artist 360 Award from the Mid-America Arts Alliance earlier this year. He also won a prestigious poetry contest at the University of the Ozarks a few years ago. So he has demonstrated an ability to help people connect to nature through his writing in the past. And that is exactly what we were looking for in an artist in residence. And the fact that he uses writing and poetry as his medium, that's a type of art that's very easy to share and spread far and wide.
And so what does having an artist in residence bring to the Park Service?
An artist can often bring a new interpretation of the importance or the significance of a place. And when we can look at that art and almost feel what the artist was feeling and what the artist was putting into it, I think that can help us just as park visitors or park stewards to feel that extra layer of connection so that they will want to further protect this park for the future, so that future generations can come and have the same sort of experience that we do today.
Lauren Ray is a park ranger with the Buffalo National River. She talked with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth. Upcoming events and information about the Artists in Residence program can be found at nps.gov/BUFF. Tomorrow in Ozarks, a scenic 720-acre wilderness tract encompassing I-49's Bobby Hopper Tunnel has been placed under conservation easement with Northwest Arkansas Land Trust.
Yeah, what you're looking at is the view shed. It's what most people think of as home when they cross under that tunnel and they see all of this mountainous terrain.
That's on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Beaver. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. And Ozarks at Large is produced at the Carver Center for Public Radio. Contributors for this Wednesday edition of Ozarks at Large included Susanna Sitek, Jacqueline Froelich, Timothy Dennis, and Daniel Carruth. Timothy also mastered our show, and he produced this week's edition of Reflections in Black. Reflections in Black, written and hosted by Raven Cook. Raven is founder and president of Foundation's Black History Educational Programming. Our theme is titled First Hurrah, and it is written and performed by Daryl Sean. You can find him often playing live on his Facebook and Instagram feeds. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thank you so much for being with us this hour. We will be back tomorrow at noon and 7. Have a great rest of your Wednesday.